Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Zalmay Khalilzad says the crisis is over after watching the country teeter for days on the brink of explosive civil war. But few others are so sure. Since the Golden Dome was blown off the Shiite Samarra Shrine last Wednesday, Baghdad's main morgue has filled with hundreds of bodies, shot, knifed, and strangled execution style. If the slide continues, if the fury mounts, the horror at the morgue could look minor. Full-blown civil war scenarios are now only two imaginable: mass ethnic cleansing, religious battle lines, and national breakup, regional meltdown, and U.S. troops stuck in the middle or running. Up next on Point, imagining the all-too-possible civil war scenarios in Iraq. Joining me now from Baghdad is Borzu Dargahi, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
You quote the Iraqi Interior Minister's intelligence chief, Hussein Ali Kamal, saying, "If the crimes and attacks increase, I do not think anyone in this country will survive. A lot of bombings there today. Is the lid on this thing yet?"
I think things have gotten to sort of a controllable level. Today, there was another upsurge in bombings and attacks, but really nothing out of the ordinary, sadly, nothing out of the ordinary for Iraq in terms of the steady drumbeat of violence.
Borzu, talk to us about the dynamics that are pushing toward more chaos and the dynamics that may rein in the chaos. What's at work here in each direction?
That's a great question. I think the significant thing that's pushing the country towards chaos is the power vacuum. That power vacuum has been filled by militias and other armed groups, and they are basically under the control of no one. No one's quite sure who they're under the control of. And they've been, for example, in the wake of the Shrine bombing, marauding through neighborhoods that maybe they shouldn't be in, they don't belong in, and taking what they perceive as revenge. Avenging the violence that has been inflicted on their community, and that is really pushing the country towards destabilization. Because what that's causing is that people are organizing neighborhood groups and other militias to combat the militias that are marauding through their neighborhoods. On the other side, you have the power of the senior Shiite clergy which has been trying, kind of desperately, sometimes unsuccessfully, to rein in the more hot-headed people. And then, of course, there's the multinational forces, the presence of about 140,000 troops. If things ever get really, really out of hand, they could step in and back up the Iraqi forces in enforcing a severe lockdown, as we saw three or four days here over the weekend, in which basically the country was put into a coma.
President Bush saying shortly before leaving for India and Pakistan that the choice the Iraqis face now is chaos or unity. We had elections in December. There was optimism then. Where does the formation of a new government stand? And might that help dampen what's going on, though? Or is that a problem itself?
I think that the government formation process is important. It's significant. The question is, do any of the groups that are discussing, any of the individuals that are discussing forming a new government, do they have any organic connection to what's happening on the street in Iraq? And that's been a problem since the beginning of this whole process. You've had these sort of parallel realities. The Green Zone, that's the U.S.-protected sort of enclave, the U.S.-protected fortress, where much of Iraq's administrative work is promoted and conducted, has its own kind of reality, whereas on the street, it's just a different, law. It's the law of the jungle. And that's been a problem all throughout this.
Do Iraqis themselves, as you speak to them, whether officials or ordinary Iraqis, do they feel that their country is on a knife's edge here, that it could topple over into full-blown sectarian violence, ethnic cleansing, civil war, People are talking about armies from neighboring countries at the border, even coming in some scenarios. Are Iraqis talking about these things?
Iraqis aren't talking about armies coming into their country quite yet, but they are extremely worried. They're extremely concerned. There's a lot of Iraqi families that are both Sunni and Shiite. You know, mom's a Sunni, dad's a Shiite, or vice versa. There's a lot of Iraqi tribes that are split along Sunni-Shiite lines. And so a civil war here along sectarian lines would be so cataclysmic that, of course, it's just contemplating it, much less watching what could be the beginnings of it unfold, is extremely traumatic.
You've written that the Lebanonization of Iraq may be coming. In fact, that it may be the best at this point that Iraqis and Americans can hope for. We saw what Beirut looked like for many years. That looked pretty bad. The best that can be hoped for?
Well, I mean, that's what's happening at this point. It seems that it's already happening. You know, already, for example, much of eastern Baghdad is patrolled by the Shiite Ministry of Interior forces, while much of western Baghdad is patrolled by the mostly Sunni Iraqi army. So you already have this sort of partitioning along these sectarian and ethnic lines. You know, the transportation and health ministries are controlled by Muqtada Sadr's people. He's a Shiite cleric, young rabble-rousing cleric. Whereas the Ministry of Defense is controlled by the Sunnis. And, you know, you've got this sort of ethnic, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is controlled by the Kurds. You've got this sort of ethnic partitioning of the country, this religious partitioning of the country already beginning to take shape.
Partitioning and, in the last week, exploding. Now today, word that the tomb of Saddam Hussein's father blown up. Not a pretty picture. Borzu Dargahi, we thank you for joining us from Baghdad.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Borzu Dargahi, a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Baghdad. We're talking civil war scenarios in Iraq and beyond in this hour. You can join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Anthony Cordesman, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He is former director of intelligence assessment in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and author of many volumes on military strategy and history. Anthony Cordesman, thank you for joining us.
Good to join you, Tom.
We don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, but we would hope that at this point people are doing some war gaming, though it doesn't look anything like a game. What kind of scenarios are legitimately, should the country, is the Pentagon thinking about now? Are we at the point where this thing could just really come undone?
We haven't made any public announcements at all of what the contingency planning is. And there haven't been any press reports that have any credibility. But it's obvious that the United States constantly looks at these cases. Now, one problem we have is we're reacting and perhaps overreacting to a few bad days. We don't know yet whether that's going to gather momentum. And there are a few bad days really in 4 out of 18 provinces. Sometimes we give the impression this is happening nationwide, but in fact it's happening in the provinces with Baghdad and Mosul and the two Sunni provinces largely to the west. We haven't seen organized nationwide patterns of violence as yet. But certainly it is possible that you could see the country begin to divide. It may not be what we're looking at, that is, a violent dispute to start with. At some point, this government will form, and then there has to be a debate over federation. If that debate over federation creates a Shiite and a Kurdish federation, the problem is that that's almost certainly a recipe for some kind of civil war, because most of the Shiite provinces have very large numbers of Sunnis, and most of the Kurdish provinces have very large minorities, many of which are already frightened and angry at the Kurds.
Anthony Cordesman, we understand it may not happen. We hope it doesn't happen, but we've come so apparently close in these recent days. It seems like it's something that's going to have to be considered. We hope planning is going on for the eventuality, if it should come. Give us sort of by degree, what's the least bad scenario in civil war? What's the worst?
Well, the least bad case is simply one where you have the kind of violence you already have. We already have a low-level civil war. And in that case, if you can put together an inclusive government, if you can strengthen the Iraqi army, if you can make good on your promise to make this the year of the police and put out local security forces but really serve the nation, then you can deal with the Civil War, and you can still turn basically both the security and the political process over to the Iraqis.
Awful lot of questions about those police. If it doesn't go so well, if it spirals out of control?
If you watch, for example, Baghdad become the equivalent of one of the Balkan cities, where you have an open fight between Sunni and Shiite, and there are a significant number of Kurds in Baghdad, or you see the same in Mosul, then the problem becomes one of having to choose between armed intervention on the part of the government with really massive urban fighting.
You mean the Iraqi government or the U.S. government?
The Iraqi government.
Mm-hmm.
That would really be the kind of case where you would have to decide, is it worth it? Are you going to actually be able to achieve a result at the end of it that will be anything other than turning American troops into targets? The worst cases are the kind which you end up with an ungovernable Iraq dividing, as we saw in the case of the former Yugoslavia, with ethnic cleansing, with people fleeing Sunni, Shiite, and Kurdish zones, with struggles over every border town and area, and where the United States is seen as the occupier and the force that, rather than stabilizing, is destabilizing.
We've been joined from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington by Anthony Cordesman. We're now joined as well from Washington by Daniel Byman. He's director of the Security Studies Program and Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, author of Deadly Connections, States That Sponsor Terrorism. Dan Byman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So here we are. The United States was hoping to be looking here at a unity government, at a more secure situation, at a troop drawdown. Suddenly all that seems to be at risk. How large are the risk factors looming in your mind right now, Dan Byman?
The risk factors are immense. There has been, of course, sustained violence for years now that people have wondered, will this be the straw that breaks the camel's back? But the recent bomb attack on the shrine in Samarra may be just that. It's the attack that shows communities they cannot trust their government. It convinces different groups that the others are out to get them. And this is exactly what we've been afraid of for months now.
So we don't want to be alarmist, but it seems like it would be silly not to be thinking about what the potentials are here. We're reading people talking about all kinds of scenarios, everything from this kind of meat grinder violence that we've seen right now to really mass ethnic cleansing, to battle lines or break up, even neighboring states intervening in Iraq, Iran, even Saudi Arabia. I mean, is that crazy to think about that, those as risks here, or are those real risks?
Unfortunately, they're real risks. That doesn't mean any of them are likely immediately, but we're seeing a steady deterioration of government in Iraq, and we're seeing violence spread to areas where in the past seemed relatively calm. And that's the fear, that communities that have in the past been relatively quiet, have not been shooting at Americans or at others, feel the need to take up arms in self-defense, and the violence spreads that way.
So paint the picture for us. Everybody hopes it doesn't happen, but if we start descending the steps to this hell, what's the vista look like? Where do we go?
There are different possibilities, none of them good. Some is that Iraq could divide into different regions controlled by warlords, often loyal to a particular tribe or in some cases a particular ethnic group. Others have neater battle lines, if you will, largely divide along ethnicity and sect, but even there you'd have tremendous internal divisions. There's also a possibility that much of Iraq, particularly in the south and central areas, will simply fragment into small area after small area, with each area warring on the other. The possibilities of outside intervention, it's unlikely to be direct troop intervention with the United States there or even with the United States in the region. But we will see, as instability spreads, outside powers feeling the need to have influence in Iraq, they are likely to increase their ties to different warlords and militant groups to provide money, to provide training, to provide weapons, all of which is going to make the problem worse.
Anthony Cordesman, in this bad scenario, what is the utility of U.S. troops? What can U.S. troops do? Do they get involved if we go into a more full-blown civil war? Do they retreat? Do they, you know, do they hunker down, or do they stride out into this mess?
Well, they're all good questions, but what they all depend on is how the situation actually evolves. If you have an uncontrollable level of violence, the United States simply can't help. We've seen in Lebanon and Somalia that there are cases where you can't have outside forces become anything other than a target. If it is lower-level violence, if you have sectarian splits at more limited areas, then the United States can support the Iraqi forces. One key issue we have is we don't have an Iraqi government, and the most likely prime minister is a weakling and an incompetent who is only going to be nominated because Sadr intervened to have him come back. Now, having just come back from the region and talking to Iraqi officers and officials, one of the great problems is that they see Jafari as part of the problem or the risk, not the solution.
But there he sits, and if he's not a solution, that keeps the risk high. If the U.S. troops can't be effective here, do they leave the region, Anthony Cordesman? Do they go into fortified bases and wait till, I don't know what, till Armageddon blows over? Of course, it depends on how it unfolds, but if they can't be effective,
Tom,
they get out or hang in.
A case in almost any direction you want to. You can postulate a case where there's no point in keeping the troops, and that can happen. You can postulate one where limited amounts of intervention will hold things together. You can postulate a case where, in spite of all the political weaknesses, the Iraqis come together simply because the alternatives are so horrible. I think that one of your great problems will be that we are committed now to a process where it'll be at least a month before there's even a government. Then there are 4 months in which, even in a good case, everybody has to argue over the most bitter issues affecting the Constitution, including federation, the control of revenues. And then if this process goes ahead, there is a 60-day referendum. That takes us into September. And as Dan pointed out, throughout that, you have a constant set of risk, even if you can make it from week to week. But without watching that play out, all we can say at this point is there are cases where it becomes so untenable that you do have to move U.S. troops out. There are cases where we may be able to intervene successfully. There are cases where simply boosting the Iraqi forces and constant U.S. pressure on the government to be more effective and inclusive can solve the problem. But none of us at this point can predict exactly what's going to happen.
Dan Byman, unknowable, but the risks at such a size now that we've got to look at it. Anthony Cordesman describes a situation in which keeping U.S. troops is untenable. They're not effective in the field. I mean, what do you see happen if we go down that road? Are they going to sit in bases in the green zone? Do those become like Dien Bien Phu, where they're attacked by, I don't know, mortars raining down on them? We've got a new Alamo here. Can you see U.S. troops on ships getting the heck out of there? Is that imaginable?
That is certainly imaginable. A lot of this will come down to what the role of the government is in all this. If the United States believes in this government, if the American people believe in the government, then the idea of the president saying that American troops are going to help the government restore order, that American troops are going to essentially take sides in an all-out civil war, is more credible and is more politically possible. But if the government is seen as inept, as part of the problem rather than part of the solution, it will be politically very hard for the president to say that American troops should be involved, because it will simply be seen as helping one bad guy against another bad guy.
But who do you side with if there's an all-out civil war? Even if you can make a case for the government clearly is not in control at that point. So who do you side with?
Well, if the government is not in control, part of the purpose of American troops would be to give a good government cards to play, to give a good government some degree of force that it can use. In essence, the United States would be trying to play kingmaker, or I think more realistically, trying to make sure that parties that are incredibly hostile to the United States or very bad for the region do not take power.
But in an all-out civil war, isn't it kind of late for that?
Oh, absolutely. But this is the problem. No one wants to begin this in an all-out civil war, but the United States has been trying to do this for several years now with, when there has been violence, just less violence. Certainly, we'd rather do it sooner rather than later.
And here now we have a little bit too good a view of the abyss. Hope we're not going there, but that way does not look good. I want to bring our callers in. Mudafa's on the line from Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, Mudafa. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. How are you?
We're well. What do you think?
I am from Iraq myself, and I am a Shiite, and I went to a refugee camp in Saudi Arabia, and I do know what kind of ideology Wahhabi carry from said to us at the refugee camp, the Saudi guards, who some of them were Wahhabi.
You're talking Sunnis here. Do you, let me just ask you, Mudafa, you're Iraqi. Do you see civil war coming, or do you think Iraqis will turn away from it?
I would say it is a civil war already, but from one side, which is mostly the former Ba'athists and the Wahhabi.
So the Sunnis. So if the Shiites have started to hit back in this last week in a serious way, what next?
Yeah, I mean, if you could let me talk, Mr. Ashcroft, I would
appreciate it.
I mean, the discussion which you have is, to be honest, I mean, your guests are talking about something else. Iraq's situation now is in misery. The reason is accumulation of bad American politics to keep each party weak so they will have the last word at the end. And also the people, the politicians who represent the so-called the Sunnis now, those politicians were represented by the U.S. And some, I could even give you the names of those politicians who are now appealing to the insurgent more than to the Iraqi unit.
And we read about them, Mudafa, but your bottom line here, do you think it's
My
going towards civil war?
It is a civil war already against the Shiites, and if you check the numbers, don't take my words, you will see that the thousands of Shiites get slaughtered and get ethnic cleansed. Just 60 families were forced to leave from Abu Ghraib, and now they live in somewhere in Baghdad. It is a civil war from one side, and unfortunately, American bad politics is by keeping everyone weak, by thinking that if the Shiites took power, this might affect long-term politics sided with Iran or this nonsense. But they forgot that they have no choice. They have to make the power to the people who deserve it.
That's the Shiites in your view. Mudafa, we've got it. Anthony Cordesman, there you hear kind of the voice of Shiites saying, we've had enough. The Sunnis are already sort of hard at civil war on us. Mudafa suggesting it's time for Shiites to push back. Is that the way toward more violence?
The problem is we've been watching the Shiites push back. We've been seeing it build up for a pattern of months. We've seen the Ministry of Interior come under the control of someone who has essentially allowed the Badr organization to play a role.
The militias.
We've seen commando units essentially become Shiite units and joining the civil war. We have reports that Sadr's militia has become much more active on the side of ethnic cleansing against Sunnis. This is not a one-sided civil war. It has been something that's been accelerating really since the election in last year. It is not something that's going to go away easily, particularly until you can create more effective Iraqi forces and convince people that they can trust the police and the special security units. And we're not sure that can be done.
And there's the phrase, civil war, not conditional, but some level we're in it. Anthony Cordesman, I know we have to let you go. We're very grateful for your time. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Goodbye. Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, author of most recently The Iraq War, Strategy, Tactics, and Military Lessons. We're joined now from Washington by Mark Mazzetti. He's Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times, been reporting that the troop cuts that Washington was hoping, the withdrawals, drawdown of U.S. troop levels that Washington was hoping to bring in this year may be in serious doubt. Now, Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what about it? There has been a lot of talk about this, you know, the Washington wanting to see those U.S. troop levels brought down, certainly before the fall elections. What does the last week tell us about the likelihood of that?
Well, if you recall, the past year, commanders in Iraq have talked about the spring of 06 as being this very critical time. A few months after the elections, it was the time they pointed to that might allow this drawdown to begin. So the violence over the last week has come right at this moment when commanders are making decisions about troop cuts for the summer. So what they're seeing is obviously, even after the elections, there was this lull in violence. Now the violence has ramped up. The question is it a right time to be cutting forces? And what they do is they have to make these decisions about 2 months in advance to start allowing troops to get ready to go on a year combat tour and to start sending equipment over to Iraq. So right now, they've got to make a decision within the next couple weeks, and there's a lot of people saying maybe the time is not right to be cutting.
You're quoting someone here saying, you know, there's a perspective here that with so much turmoil, how can you possibly think about drawing down at this point? But the pressure from Washington must be enormous for them to draw down.
Well, of course, the president says that all decisions are based on the advice from commanders in the field and not from, you know, Capitol Hill or pressure by lawmakers. There's also a consciousness in the Pentagon that you really can't keep this size of the force in Iraq because of the personnel strains that, in particular, the Army is experiencing. On the flip side, there are people who are saying that, well, let's look at what did not happen in the last week. There was not a full-blown battle across Iraq that required U.S. troops. And, in fact, Iraqi Army units did perform fairly well, much better than expected.
Mm-hmm.
So the counter-argument is, well, if this was the first real test of the Iraqi security forces under this new regime, maybe they did well, and maybe we can allow them greater responsibility in the future. And that's a case for cutting the U.S. presence.
We're reading here a poll coming out today, Zogby poll of American military personnel in Iraq, finding 72% saying U.S. troops should be pulled out within 1 year. Only 23% saying stay as long as necessary. Of those who think they should go, nearly a third saying U.S. troops should withdraw immediately. That's a grunt-level view of the war that says, get us out of here.
Well, I think you're probably seeing a degree of convergence from the grunt-level view and to the highest levels of the military view. I mean, we're past the argument of do we need more troops in Iraq? No one's really, even I don't think John McCain is still making that point.
Because they're not needed or because they're simply not there?
Because I think they realize that they're not getting them, and that there's a certain degree of acceptance that enough Iraqi units will be trained within the next year to allow the U.S. to begin pulling out. So this year time frame that you're talking about in that poll, the commanders at the top levels sort of buy in that as well. They think they need another year of this, you know, pretty large presence. But if the Iraqi army and police units begin performing, they can start cutting U.S. troops.
Mark Mazzetti at the Pentagon, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Mark Mazzetti with the Los Angeles Times. We've been joined from Washington by Daniel Byman, Director of the Security Study Program in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, author of Deadly Connections, States That Sponsor Terrorism. We're joined right now, as well, from Fyrsdal, Norway, by Peter Galbraith, Senior Diplomatic Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, former U.S. Ambassador to Croatia. It was in Baghdad just yesterday for a week or more. Peter Galbraith, thanks very much for being with us.
What's up, Tom? Good to be back with you.
Now, you've got an interesting perspective here. You've been a strong supporter of the Kurds throughout. As I understand you, you've said maybe Iraq should be broken up. Are we now on the path to a civil war breakup of this country?
We certainly are. I mean, the civil war entered into a new phase with the destruction of the Askariya Shrine in Samarra. But there had been a civil war going on for at least 2 years. It had been characterized by Sunni Arab attacks, insurgents, and former Ba'athists, as well as al-Qaeda, against Shiite politicians, religious leaders, pilgrims, and ordinary people.
So if we're already in the midst of it, is this as bad as it's going to get? Is this all it's going to take to sort of dissolve the bonds and, you know, bring us to autonomous states there, or are we going to get into a worse bloodbath?
But the bonds never existed. Iraq was a country held together by force from its founding to 2003 with Sunni Arab dictators. The United States destroyed all of that, and the dissolution of the country was the almost inevitable result.
So are we headed into a bloodbath here, or can it dissolve, you know, without getting worse than it already is?
Well, if we continue on a course of action which is aimed to create a unitary state, it will get much worse. If we do what we should have done in Yugoslavia in 1991, which was not to try to hold it together, but to manage the breakup so there wasn't a war. I don't think we can avoid the violence, but I think we can minimize it.
A unitary state is exactly U.S. policy. That's the goal. So if we hang on to that, what do you think it's going to look like?
Well, let's take the security forces. We have been committed to the idea that we're going to create an Iraqi army and an Iraqi police force. The trouble is that the people who are in those police forces and in that army don't think of themselves as Iraqis. They think of themselves as Shiites or Kurds, Sunni Arabs. If you have we think that the Iraqi army is going into the Sunni Arab areas to patrol, but the people on the ground, they see a primarily Shiite army and an army aligned with the hated enemy, Iran. You can't create institutions where people don't have a shared commitment to the state itself.
So we've got your view. If we push this string, what happens? Do we end up with our internal armies, battle lines in Iraq, Iran supporting the Shiites, Saudis and others supporting the Sunni? Is that where we're headed?
But most of this has already happened. Of course, in the north, you have a de facto independent Kurdistan with its own army. The Iraqi army is not even allowed to enter Kurdistan. It's the most powerful army in the country. In the south, you have a variety of Shiite militias, some separate from the government, like the Mahdi army of radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. But you also have others that have been incorporated into the police and the army, like the Badr organization associated with the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq.
So is it manageable intervention and tension, or are we headed here toward, people are even talking about regional meltdown?
Well, it's certainly, I mean, what was striking to be in Baghdad these last 10 days, and particularly after this crisis broke, is that there were two realities in the city. Inside the Green Zone, there were endless meetings among politicians, and outside the Green Zone, almost immediately following the destruction of the Askariya Shrine in Samarra, the Mahdi army that is associated with this radical cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, had taken over much of the city and was orchestrating attacks on Sunni mosques. And the government was essentially powerless.
Dan Byman, is this too pessimistic a view?
It's certainly a realistic view. It doesn't mean it's the most likely scenario. There are parts of Iraq that have almost no loyalty to the central government. There are parts that see themselves as Iraqi. And there are many parts that are simply seeking good government and are willing to turn to leaders, whether they're local, regional, or national, depending on who can offer it to them. And the hope is to make the central government more effective and more compelling than some of the local alternatives. That's going to be very hard in some cases.
Peter Galbraith says it will never work. That trying to push that, the unitary state position, just is a recipe itself for civil war.
The historical record on this sort of thing is mixed. There are times when the identities are simply too hard and too hostile to make it work. There are other times when this has been overcome. You can look around the world and find examples in both cases. But the problem in Iraq is this neat separation works for part of the country. It works for the Kurdish north, but it doesn't work nearly as well for the Shia and Sunni areas. Baghdad itself, the largest city in the country, is a mixed city. Who gets what? These divisions could be exceptionally bloody, and partitions in the past have been bloody when you've had these disputes.
Steve's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
How are you?
We're all right.
I wanted to, Mr. Byman, I think it is, made a comment a little while ago.
Daniel Byman, yes.
Sort of pushing out the deadlines and things are going to get better by this point and that point. I've been listening to talking heads, politicians, John McCain, other people for 2 years now, 3 years, saying it'll get better after this point, it will get better after this point, and none of these things ever come to fruition. I'm wondering, what is the drop-dead point where whatever's going to happen there is going to happen. We have no control over it. We might as well just withdraw and let it happen suffer the guilt and international infamy of we created the mess, but there was nothing we could do to fix it. The pottery barn principle goes.
Yeah, it's broken, but we don't want to own it anymore. I hear the question. I think it's a question on a lot of minds. Steve, let me put it, and I imagine we may get two different answers. I should point out, along the way, new poll finds President Bush's approval rating has now fallen to an all-time low of 34%. The ports controversy can't have helped this, but neither can this trouble in Iraq. Peter Galbraith, I'll put it first to you. You know, Steve says, we've heard it's getting better, and then this, I think this feels to me like where the American public opinion is teetering right now. How should Americans look at what's going on there?
Steve is exactly right, and he's been that he's been correct in this analysis almost from the beginning. We invaded a country about which we knew very little, and frankly, the administration didn't care to learn very much about. But now we're in the worst possible place. We're in the middle of somebody else's civil war, that is, the war between Iraq's Sunni Arabs and its Shiites, and both sides are blaming us. The Sunnis blame us for not protecting them. The Shiites, listen to Muqtada al-Sadr. He said that the United States is now worse than Saddam. It invaded Iraq for the purpose of preventing the return of the 12th Shiite imam who disappeared under that Askariya shrine, that we in some way are responsible for its destruction.
Daniel Bimon, all the talk about getting better, could it really all be moonshine? A lot of effort and money put in there.
I think the caller misunderstood my point. I was trying to say that the hope that the Iraqi security forces would magically be better in a year, I think, is a hope and an unrealistic one at that. This is a question, which is, have we reached the point where we simply can't expect to do more good? I think we can still do significant good, in particular with regard to the question of avoiding an all-out civil war. If you spend enough time in the Middle East or studying the Middle East, one thing you know is that things can always get worse. And this is a problem we have to think about, which is, what if the refugee flows go from hundreds of people or thousands of people to tens or hundreds of thousands? What if the deaths we've seen in the past few days become the norm rather than the exception? And these are serious issues for U.S. policy, in particular because this is a critical region. Now, the answer to this still might be drawing down U.S. forces considerably. It might be removing U.S. forces in a fairly short period of time. But to simply throw up our hands at this point and say, well, what we wanted to accomplish hasn't worked, I think ignores some of the real dangers that might happen should we leave immediately.
But what happens if it really falls completely apart into a Sunni on Shia with the Kurds in the north, open war, ethnic cleansing, and the rest? Play that on out. What do the Saudis do? What do the Iranians do? What about oil supplies? What about regional stability? Walk us through that.
A lot of possibilities, but one surety to me is that all countries in the region try to expand their influence there. So Saudi Arabia, Syria, Turkey, all are working with local warlords along their borders and in general to try to influence things. The biggest player would be Iran, which has a large intelligence and probably paramilitary presence.
So Iraq becomes a series of vassal states under the influence of the nearest neighbor of like sect?
Unfortunately, I believe it would be even worse. It would be Iraq becomes a series of small enclaves of warlords with different foreign powers grappling for influence.
What does that mean for regional stability? What does that mean for oil flow?
That's quite serious for regional stability. One danger that people talk about with regard to Iraq is that rather than being a magnet for jihadists, with jihadists coming in, Iraq could be a new swamp, that jihadists are bred there and they go out throughout the region.
The new Afghanistan, the new Taliban Afghanistan.
Exactly. We saw this in Jordan, where fighters from Iraq went from Iraq to Jordan to do the attacks in the hotels there. If this happened in Saudi Arabia, where several hundred people, a relatively small number, went from Iraq to Saudi Arabia, this wouldn't topple the Saudi regime, but it would create instability in the world's largest oil producer and really transform the region further, spreading instability, creating real dangers, and it's something we need to consider.
Is this within anybody's control at this point, or are we, it sometimes feels like we're at the whim of events.
Control is a strong word. I would say that we can influence the probabilities, that you can try to make the jihadist presence more on the run. You can put pressure on it. You can try to shore up the Saudi security forces. But there's a lot going on in Iraq in particular that we have very little control over. The recent events, I think, illustrate that vividly, where one attack seemed to transform the country.
If we get the kind of regional meltdown option that Daniel Bimon's talking about, of warlord states and instability leaking out of Iraq, what happens to oil? What happens to the world economy? Can the world deal with that and go on with the status quo, Peter Galbraith?
Well, I think what Dan described, I think very well, is actually, much of it is already happening. And we see it an impact certainly on Iraqi oil supplies, which since the fall of Saddam never reached the pre-war level, but which also have been declining. And part of the reason it's declining is that oil is simply disappearing. 250,000 barrels disappear from the meter point in Basra between there and getting on the ship in the Persian Gulf, and it's disappearing in the pipelines that go through the Sunni areas. And it's likely that, that this, I mean, it's quite possible this trend will continue. Now, I think Dan Bynum's suggestion that you could have people going from Iraq attacking oil facilities in Saudi Arabia, that's possible, and it could certainly greatly unsettle the markets.
Our time is short, and there are too many gruesome options on the table. What's the best prescription at this point, given what we're confronting, Peter Galbraith? What's your view?
First, I think we have to recognize that the U.S. forces in Iraq are not accomplishing very much. And so I think we ought to be drawing them down. And one of the things they are doing, though, is they are preventing us from taking effective action to deal with Iran, because we've got 130,000 hostages that, should we take it, be forced to take some military action because of Iran's nuclear program, they can retaliate.
Well, our time is so short. Are you saying accept a broken-up Iraq? Is that your recipe?
It has already happened, and we are not going to put in the resources to bring the Shiite south back under Baghdad's control. That isn't going to happen. Incidentally, Iraq doesn't. It had elections in December. It doesn't have a government yet, and there is total deadlock. And it is a deadlock among the different ethnic and sectarian groups: Kurds, Sunnis, Shiites.
Daniel Bynum, we've got half a minute. What's your recipe in this nasty picture?
The recipe is continue pushing the government hard to make it more inclusive. It is considering ways to draw the U.S. presence down intelligently while still being able to influence events. And it is trying to work with responsible local leaders as much to influence things, all the while making sure that the government is not getting too far ahead of Congress and the American people, because what can happen then is that we sell expectations we can't deliver on.
Very different recipes at a time when things look extremely unsettled. I want to thank both of you for being with us. Peter Galbraith, former U.S. Ambassador to Croatia, former professor of national security strategy at the National War College, author of the forthcoming book, The End of Iraq. Ambassador Galbraith, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, good to be with you.
And Daniel Bynum, author of Deadly Connections and director of the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. Daniel Bynum, thanks for being here.
Tom, thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Download the On Point podcast, or subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.